know how to develop high-quality instructional frameworks in the form of qualitative rubrics describing practice, how can you identify the biggest and best opportunities to develop those frameworks for specific areas, right? We can't do everything. We should not attempt to develop a rubric for every single practice. So we want to be judicious about focusing our attention on the best opportunities. And there are three criteria that you can use to identify those best opportunities. You want to focus on developing shared expectations for practices that are high frequency, so practices that teachers use often, perhaps every day, perhaps multiple times per class period. You want to focus on practices that are high impact, right? We're not going to focus on things like, you know, how you take attendance or, you know, little, you know, which signal is the best for getting kids' attention. Like, it really should make a big difference to get everyone aligned on that practice. And it shouldn't be arbitrary or focused on, you know, somebody's kind of pet issue. And finally, it should be high variability. There should be a big difference in how different teachers are doing in that particular area, where some people are doing really well, other people are doing very poorly, and therefore there's a big opportunity for improvement that comes from alignment. If we're missing any of those characteristics of high frequency, high impact, or high variability, it's probably not our best opportunity for developing shared expectations, and our effort is probably going to be better invested somewhere else, where we do have high frequency, high impact, and high variability. Because when we've developed a rubric in one of those high frequency, high impact, high variability areas, we've created a roadmap for growth that's going to actually benefit students. Teachers are going to get better at something that matters to students a lot and often, and that improvement will yield tangible results for students. So this is something that we talk about a little bit in chapter 20 of Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership. So you may want to review that chapter to help you decide on a particular focus and what particular topics to develop instructional frameworks around first. You may also want to use your observations and your conversations with teachers to help you figure out what those best opportunities are. And one particular strategy that I want to share with you that will help bring some of those opportunities to the surface is to cluster your either one-on-one conversations, if you're not able to get into classrooms in person, or your observations, if you are able to get into classrooms in person, your classroom walkthroughs, to cluster those by team. Because when you see different teachers in the same grade level or same department or same subject area teaching around the same time, you are going to see different patterns than if you just kind of visit people at random. And this is going to be part of a longstanding pattern that you develop. If you develop a consistent rotation of seeing every staff member on a regular basis, you know, like every 2 weeks, or talking with them on the phone every 2 weeks if you're in all virtual mode, then you're going to start to see patterns as you visit each team. You're going to learn a lot that you would otherwise miss if you're not visiting people by team. So you may want to cluster grade levels. You may want to cluster observations to the same subject taught by different people. You may want to visit one department all back to back. And you want to do that very close in time. Like if you can observe the same lesson taught by different people in the, you know, the same grade level, just all at the same time, just go right from one to the other, you're going to see a lot more that gives you information about some of your best opportunities to develop shared expectations. So consider doing that. If you know, if you have been visiting people kind of haphazardly or just kind of how you feel like it, you may want to change up the order. And then once you do that, stick with the order so you're not over visiting some people and hardly ever seeing other people. You know, you want to get a consistent rotation, but make sure it's a rotation that you are happy with in terms of its ability to get you into similar teachers' classrooms, kind of back to back, you know, same team, same department. Another place you can look for ideas about fruitful opportunities to develop instructional frameworks is to actually look at your curriculum. And, you know, I shouldn't have to say this, but I feel like I really do. Don't be afraid of curriculum. It is not beneath you. It is not above your head. It is squarely your business as an instructional leader to think about curriculum and to engage with teachers on issues of curriculum. And it breaks my heart, honestly, when people become administrators and then they stop going to curriculum-based professional development. They stop going to initial use trainings for new curriculum. They stop going to workshops in particular subject areas just because they don't apply to all staff. And they say, oh, I'm only going to go to things that apply to all staff. I'm not going to go to anything just for science or just for language arts. Don't make that mistake. Get yourself to that curriculum-specific professional development, because on a day-to-day basis, that's where teachers are spending most of their energy and attention, right? They're not thinking about teach like a champion techniques or general things that apply to all teachers K-12 in the Danielson framework. They're thinking about their students and their subject area and their grade level and what subject they teach. And you've got to get your head in that game as well if you're going to find some of the biggest opportunities to help teachers improve and recognize that they're not going to be the same for every grade level and department. So strive to understand the internal logic of your curriculum. If you have a spiral math curriculum, you need to know that and understand what that means for pacing and for teaching to mastery and things like that. There's some internal design logic for every curriculum that you've got to be aware of. And don't be afraid to dig deep and say, okay, what really are our big opportunities here within this particular subject area? And then if you're adding on expectations, if you're saying, okay, this curriculum accomplishes XYZ, but we also need to do these other things to supplement, you've got to at least know what you're adding on to. For example, when we adopted a new math curriculum, one of the things we chose to keep from our previous approaches to teaching math was math fact fluency, right? We didn't think the new curriculum had enough emphasis on multiplication facts and, you know, getting those really solid at the upper grade levels in elementary. So we really dialed into that and kept that, even though it wasn't part of the new curriculum. Another place you might look for where to focus and where to develop your first frameworks is around what students need. And if you are all virtual right now, or if you have many students who are virtual, you may need to look in areas other than pedagogy, other than instruction. We may need to not look at the finer points of how to do chemistry labs or give feedback on term papers. We may need to look lower down in Maslow's hierarchy of needs and ask ourselves, are we even in touch with our students? What do we do about our students that we're not getting a hold of at all? And really consider some of those basic physiological needs. You know, do they have food? Do they have electricity? Is the student housed? You know, maybe we need to stop worrying so much for particular students about why they're not doing their assignments and really look at why they're not thriving more broadly. We may need to look at other supports that we could provide for some of our students. And that may actually be our biggest opportunity for improvement, to meet some of those basic needs. There may be conditions that we could set that would allow them to participate. Maybe they can't have a private workspace at home where they can turn their webcam on and have the ability to fully participate, but maybe they can listen in with headphones. Maybe they can do their work even if they can't fully engage the way we want them to. And finally, maybe we need to think about what would actually be worth logging on for. How can we create learning opportunities for our students that would actually get them to show up when they don't have to? Those may be some of our biggest opportunities in times of virtual learning. And I think I've shared my rubric for non-responsive students, in terms of how teachers can engage and reach out to and try to reconnect with students who are not participating in virtual learning. This kind of thing may be more important than the standard elements of pedagogy in a given subject area. So don't overlook those opportunities. And in your journal, go ahead and pull that out now and reflect. What are my best opportunities for developing instructional frameworks right now? What would be the most high frequency, high impact, and high variability practices to build shared understandings around? Do some reflection in your journal, and when you've done that, you're ready to move on to the next section.